At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
It began with knocks at the window, then an irritating scratching noise like a rodent gnawing at her bedpost, followed by a strange suckling like a newborn infant getting a meal. But Betsy's mother no longer nursed, and it happened in the still of night. Betsy's father, John, an honest, God-fearing Christian farmer, her mother, Lucy, her sister Esther, and four brothers living in the home at the time, John, Drury, Joel, and Richard, would soon collectively experience this arrival of something mysterious and malign. And almost as quickly as it appeared, it would disappear. But that wouldn't be for some years yet. The torment it would inflict and its intent on harm was going to take some time. Soon enough, the entire family would experience their bed covers ripped violently from their beds in the middle of the night, and their hair pulled. Furniture was overturned and stones littered the floor. The Bell family would initially keep quiet about what the children were quick to call out. They had a ghost, and a mean one. John Bell would admonish them. They were to keep quiet. What would people think? But quickly enough, it became evident an especially malicious focus of whatever this was turned to Betsy herself. Just 12 at this time, and described as tall, pretty, blue-eyed, with the finest yellow hair, kind, innocent, and said to be well-liked by everyone. She would be subjected to continued hair-pulling, pinching, and slapping from an unseen force, hard enough to leave imprints of fingers on her porcelain skin. It became clear this wasn't going to stop. The Bells needed help. So, before long, the town knew, and visitors would arrive to experience the haunting activity themselves. As neighbors, friends, and other locals treated themselves to the show, the activity grew in strength, becoming more bizarre by the month. What started as a strange mumbling became clear words spouting random Bible verses, shameful secrets of the villagers, of Betsy, profanity, howling, singing, and then a clear indication that Betsy wasn't its only or even its main target. In fact, since whatever this was had gained the ability to speak, it made its dislike of the Bell's patriarch clearly known, vowing to keep after him until the end of his days. Soon enough, while the children's ghost continued its outward torment of Betsy, producing phantom pins from nowhere to stick her until she screamed, it began its work on John from the inside out. He became afflicted with strange ailments not experienced by even one of the other bells. Random bodily twitching, a swelling of the tongue enough to keep him quiet for entire days at a time. That went on for a year. And then, the seizures. The final of which would have him take to his bed. A disembodied voice cackled and rejoiced. Oh, I've got him this time. He will never get up from that bed again. And he wouldn't. John soon slipped into a coma. 3 years into this haunting by what had become known to be the Bell Witch, John Bell succumbed to death. The voice cackled, hooped, and hollered. Oh, it had won. It had kept after him until his final day. It claimed to have finished the job with the aid of poison, a small vial of which was found the following day in the medicine cabinet, right where John's regular medicine should have been. The tale of the Bell Witch has gone down in the annals of paranormal lore as one of the darkest examples of an evil haunting at its worst. What was thought to be the angry ghost of a local witch had tormented a family for years, used and abused children for its entertainment, destroyed an engagement, turned lives upside down, and killed a man. But then again, it seems fairly evident, at least to me, that this was no run-of-the-mill ghost. The story has all the hallmarks of an out-and-out poltergeist. And I have since collected my thoughts following my conversation with Joel Stern, who translated the Polish book written about the case of Jowasza Gajewski and her poltergeist from the 80s. Crazy case. But I have settled comfortably on what a poltergeist is, what can cause one, what one of these cases look like. And it looks like what took place with the Bell family. So, can a poltergeist kill? This far into the season, I've seen more than enough examples of a poltergeist affecting the physical in ways that harm individuals that are involved. It takes a target, often a young girl, going through puberty, battling with the change in hormones, and sometimes something traumatic. We have Betsy, the perfect age, coming into adulthood. As to what could have been traumatic enough for Betsy's unconscious psychokinetic manifestations going so far as to kill her own father? Well, people have had their suspicions. So, can a poltergeist kill a person? I would say undoubtedly, yes. If it can throw sharp objects, materialize things to stick you with, slap, pinch, pull, start fires, cause illness, all of which we saw with Jowasza's case, most of which we saw with Betsy's, it's a pretty safe assumption to make that it could unalive someone. But the poltergeist phenomenon is target-caused. Unconscious as it may be, it is psychokinetically, emotionally charged, living human created. So, with that said, my next question is, can an actual ghost kill a person? Welcome back to the Paranormal Girl podcast. I am your host, Kristen. In our previous episode, we considered earthbound spirits of the wronged who relied on the world of the living to exact justice and to bring them peace. But what if the deceased could take matters into their own spectral hands? What if, instead of going quietly into that dark, mysterious night, they stood rooted in the physical, unwilling to budge, and with a new, darker purpose? Not unrestful. No, no. Angry. Not searching for peace, but revenge. And ain't nobody gonna carry it out but them. This is the stuff of which the truly scariest ghost stories are made. And this is the stuff that confuses people into thinking the Bell Witch was a ghost and not a human-created poltergeist, which it most assuredly was. When ghosts help solve their own murders, or right a wrong, we should consider the extent to which the ghost in these stories might connect with living agents for help. They can do so via dreams, connecting with mediums, visual manifestation, auditory manifestation. But in none of these tales do the phantoms physically interfere. They can't literally grab the finger of their living relative and aim it at their killer, or physically pull the hidden will out from wherever it was stashed behind the brick basement wall. They are no longer in the physical. They must abide by a different set of rules. So, why would it be any different for the ghost of a more evil-inclined person? Is a ghost filled with evil thoughts more powerful, somehow, than one motivated by good, by justice, by love? My gut tells me no. But we do suddenly seem to think so whenever we step foot into a haunted location, don't we? Some examples that I will cover today support what my gut is telling me. That being said, though, today we will consider some of the ways a regular run-of-the-mill ghost might be able to cause harm or death. And because, in theory, they must abide by the same non-physical rules that a ghost helping to solve their own murder does, we'll explore the very creative ways in which they might do so. So, to begin with, I want to introduce you to a creature from Scandinavian and Norwegian folklore, and I'm going to get ahead of this. I full well know that I am mispronouncing this word, and I'm just going to go ahead and do it because I cannot pronounce it correctly. I can't. I have tried, you guys. I have tried. So I know this is the mispronounced version of this word, and I'm so sorry about it to any Scandinavian or Norwegian listeners who are listening. I am so sorry. We're going to call it the Gengangr. Look it up. Look it up, and you tell me if you can pronounce that, fellow Americans, okay? So, the Gengangr. This word can be translated to mean something like again walker, or one who walks again. Many of the countries in the surrounding areas would take on their own version of this entity, but at its core, the Gengangr was malicious, violent, and vengeful. You really did not want to be faced with one of these revenants, and many precautions were taken to prevent them from forming in the first place. An example of a precaution taken was the carrying of the person's coffin around the church three times before burying it. Seems like a strange, you know, superstition, but you wanted the person about to be buried to be happy and at peace enough to stay in their grave. And this was something that would ensure that. Anyone could become a Gengangr in death, though particular people were thought to be more likely to, such as suicide victims, people who were murdered, and murderers themselves. Gengangrs were the unrested, with unfinished business or wrongs to make right. However, they returned from the grave in order to torment people for it, which is just very rude. The Gengangr is often equated to what we understand as the ghost today. I don't believe that's accurate. They seem more like a zombie to me. Yeah. Look it up. Look up the pictures in the descriptions and you tell me if you disagree with that. But yeah, seems like a zombie. I just watched 28 Days Later again last night. It's like one of my favorite movies. But anyway, I want to introduce you to this concept, the Gengaiger, because I think it gave birth to a counterpart that would be more appropriately considered a ghost. More accurately, a violent ghost. While the Gengaiger had a corporeal form, so physical, sometimes appearing indistinguishable from a regular living human, in later Swedish folklore, the traditional Gengaiger gave way to something called a ghast. The ghast could appear to the living as an animated skeletal figure, sometimes with fangs and claws, or as a transparent phantom. The ghast was thought to be the cause behind certain diseases, but was also thought to cause accidents. It was also known to scare people just for the thrill of it, because it wanted to. These guys are the worst. So we can see these same ideas of what a violent ghost is capable of in our beliefs about them today. The question has been asked multiple times across Reddit and Quora and other forums. Can a ghost harm or kill you? The usual response is, yeah, actually, though not directly. I have read modern discussions where people think violent ghosts hell-bent on harming the living can cause disease. They can sap your energy enough to literally drain you dry and make you too weak to survive. It's indeed thought that they can indirectly cause accidents that might kill a person, from appearing suddenly in front of cars, causing a wreck, to creating some kind of event that might cause a person to trip and fall down the stairs. Some accounts even claiming the ghost itself pushed or did the tripping. It's thought that a person could literally die from the mere sight of a ghost. Scared to death. And yes, in theory, all of that is conceivable. But I do wonder how much these ideas about those capabilities hinge on cultural and folkloric beliefs that have carried over through history alone versus real life and modern accounts of these things happening.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Asian cultures have an overwhelming number of examples of violent, vengeful ghosts. Today, I will highlight one called the Widow Ghost out of Thailand and surrounding areas. In rural areas of Southeast Asia, young, healthy men were dying unexpectedly in their sleep. These strange deaths occurred in the Philippines, Thailand, Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia, and were attributed to the legend of the Widow Ghost, a vicious, insatiable woman, unhappy in life, who now spent her afterlife stealing men while they were most vulnerable, during sleep in the wee hours of the morning. If this sounds familiar and you are a fan of the horror genre, you may recognize the phenomenon from the Nightmare on Elm Street lore. Wes Craven had been inspired by numerous newspaper articles about Hmong refugees who suffered from disturbing nightmares, some outright refusing to sleep, and a few who dared to died before morning, succumbing to sudden unexplained nocturnal death syndrome. For over a century, this sleep death, or Lay Thai, claimed the lives of young male villagers in northeastern Thailand. It was thought that good-looking men were in danger of being taken. Being the only son of the family put them in danger of being taken. Over the years, the locals had found ways to ward off the evil widow ghost, ways to protect their loved ones in times when the widow ghost was on her way to their village. Some took to cross-dressing as women before falling asleep. Some of the men painted their nails. Some wore lipstick. The idea being, if the widow could be tricked into believing these men were women, she would not take them. Red shirts could be hung at the entrance to their homes, red being the color for women. Some might install signs next to the shirts reading, "No man is in here." The widow ghost foiled yet again. Phallic symbols were hung around necks, over doorways, at the gates to the village for protection and good luck. Erect penises were added to scarecrows. Quite the distraction for a lady ghost in need. Small male dolls with erect penises could be hung by the entrance of the home in hopes the widow might mistake it for a real man and make off with it gleefully into the night before realizing she had been tricked. Again, she's like, "Hey, wait a gosh darn minute. This isn't what I wanted." Though all of these very creative precautions were taken, and though the confirmation bias said that it made a difference, it actually did not. Men were still dying suddenly in their sleep. It wasn't until 1994 that a modern medical scientific lens was applied to the situation, and a very reasonable reason was uncovered to explain the phenomenon. In certain ethnic groups of Southeast Asia, including the Hmong and their descendants, a susceptibility to cardiac weakness can be found. It is thought to be related or under the umbrella of Brugada syndrome, which is a genetic heart condition that causes irregular heartbeats and is a major cause of sudden cardiac death in otherwise normal, healthy young men. Brugada is rare, but is far more common in people of Asian descent. So the widow ghost, thought for 100 years to be mass murdering a population, was in fact not. That doesn't quite stop the persistence of the legend, though. Even as recent as 2013, there was a published account of a Thai village who had lost at least 4, and depending on the source, up to 12 young, healthy men who just dropped dead or died in their sleep. The villagers hired a medium who told them it was the widow and to get to hang in their shirts and signs to stop her. Belief is an insanely powerful force, and so the legend of the widow lives on. On March 10th, 1855, an article was published in the Sheffield and Rotherham Independent detailing the death of a young woman who had died at the hands of a ghost. Kind of. Hannah Rawlinson was visiting her friends, the Favels, at their home at the end of Campo Lane. She was aware of the excitement that had recently been stirred in the home. Weeks prior, Mr. Favell had seen a woman's face staring out at him from the cellar kitchen window, and upon returning into the house and down to the cellar to investigate, found tipped and broken glass on the floor with no apparent cause. A week later, the Favells' housemate, Mrs. Ward, would brave the cellar and witness a sight that would make her faint in her tracks. An elderly woman in a white nightgown and cap situated near the mantelpiece. Shortly following this, over dinner one night, Mrs. Ward would say she again had seen the apparition, but this time it stood on the cellar steps and was covered in blood. Following this, fellow LDS congregants of the Favells and Rawlinsons would excitedly come to the home to see the very spot the ghost had stood and been witnessed, descending the stairs by candlelight and spooking the bejesus out of themselves. The story of the ghostly, bloody woman spread quickly to the neighbors and beyond, and folks had taken to gathering at the front gate, crowding around to catch a glimpse of an apparition through the cellar window. 1855 was not popping. This was exciting stuff. It got so ridiculous that the Favels decided one evening to hang a blind in the window to discourage the looky-loos out on the street. Mrs. Rawlinson volunteered to be part of the party to go into the dark cellar to hang it. Upon turning back to the stairs, she gasped, "Oh dear, I saw something on the steps. Take me away." That's a quote from the article. Take me away. She fainted herself as she was assisted back up the steps, along with gathering in crowds to see your neighbor's ghost, ladies gracefully getting the vapors, also a popular pastime in the mid-1800s. If you didn't know that, now you know that. Rawlinson, upon her recovery, would relay that she had seen the elderly woman materialize on the steps, come toward her, and vanish as it passed. To Rawlinson's credit, the newspaper story does note that at this time, she was visibly terrified by what she claims to have seen. A few days later, Mrs. Ward, not to be outdone, claimed she'd seen the woman on the steps yet again. Now it stood at the top, staring at her. This sent Rawlinson into a fainting fit from which she would never recover. She would die from fright early the next morning. True story. But if there is one singularly important thing to take away from this account, it is the power of belief and the ability of a story to reach such a fever pitch that it can have dire consequences. We can already see how the story built on itself from day one. First, it's, you know, maybe a face in the window and some broken pottery. Then a second person sees the ghost. Then the ghost is seen again, but now it's covered in blood. Then the ghost isn't standing in one spot, but it's rushing at people in the dark. So on and so forth. And the story didn't end there. Following Rawlinson's death, even bigger crowds began to form on the street outside the house. One night, the front door was broken into, shutters were torn down, and scores of people filed into the cellar to see the murdered ghost. Days later, neighboring buildings, doors, and windows were vandalized and broken into. The ghost could be anywhere, anywhere, I tell you. Watchmen and officers were hired to patrol the grounds. It got so bad. Stories began to surface from others who encountered the spirit. A watchman had been so frightened by the sight, he was taken to the infirmary. A man fell into a terrified fit after seeing her and was carried away, it's said, in a dying state. Rumors started of the murder victim's bones buried under the floor of the cellar that had been found. Fellow LDS members, by gum, had seen the nightgown-wearing, blood-covered old woman for themselves with a piece of paper in her hands. Squinting, I'm sure, they could just make out the scribbled confirmation. 27 years ago, a woman had been murdered and buried in the cellar. Confirming what they'd already heard. It's like a fishing story, you guys. It is certainly true that Mrs. Rawlinson was scared to death. It is on her actual death certificate. Was a real ghost, or a ghost that she and others fused together and conflated, to blame, though? Belief in ghosts, rather than a ghost itself, has undoubtedly killed. In 1803, folks in the Hammersmith area of London were claiming to see and even be attacked by the ghost of a suicide victim. The ghost was tall and dressed all in white. The man had been buried in the churchyard, but having committed suicide, could not rest and had taken to accosting anyone who dared walk around living. How dare you, flaunting their ability to breathe? Two women were said to have been seized by the spirit and were so frightened, they both died. They didn't. A man, walking with his friend through the churchyard, watched the spirit rise behind a tombstone before it grabbed him by the throat. He fought him off, though. No, no biggie. On another night, a watchman spotted the apparition and gave chase, only to lose him. The Hammersmith ghost panic was real, dudes. A patrol group of armed citizens was formed and tasked with finding the ghost and putting a stop to its shenanigans. In early 1804, one of these citizens, Francis Smith, patrolled late at night, ready to catch the spirit in the act. He crept along, shotgun in his grasp. Then he stopped short. There it stood, just down the way. Tall, white, male. Ghost. Damn you! Who are you and what are you? Damn you! I'll shoot you! And he did. He shot the ghost. Except that he didn't. He shot Thomas Millwood, a local bricklayer who, dressed all in white, complete with white apron and hat, who was returning home late from visiting family. Thomas died, and Francis was tried for murder and convicted. This conviction set a legal precedent in the UK that someone could still be held liable for a crime, even if their doing of the crime was the consequence of a mistaken belief. Following the trial, the true ghost would come forward, an elderly shoemaker who had been donning a white sheet in order to frighten his apprentice. All right, let's take a look at some examples that don't require belief or even previous knowledge of the ghost or haunting where the ghost in question is thought to have had a hand to play in a person's death. Let's see if we get anywhere with this. In July of 2002, Unsolved Mysteries aired an episode about a case they called the Black Hope Curse. The story followed two couples, Sam and Judith Haney, and their neighbors, Ben and Jean Williams. The story is crazy overwhelming and involves a haunting that basically took place over an entire housing subdivision, with all who lived there reporting very strange activity taking place in their homes. But the most severe of the activity, I suppose, centers around the Haneys and the Williams. In 1981, Sam and Judith purchased their new home in a brand new subdivision in Crosby, Texas. A year or so after moving in, Sam began digging to construct an in-ground pool. The story goes, after he started doing this, a mysterious old man showed up at his door and told him that he was about to hit human remains. He knew this because he had put them there back in the day when the lot was an African-American cemetery, before developers had completely bulldozed over it to put in the homes. Kind of weird, you know, kind of spooky, but the developers didn't say anything about no cemetery, so Sam continued to dig and quickly hit human remains. Two coffins, side by side. An official exhumation was conducted. Most of the bones had disintegrated, but fragments and two wedding rings were discovered in the remains. It was later discovered the remains in the two boxes belonged to Charlie and Betty Thomas, a married couple who had been born into slavery and freed during the Civil War. They had died in the 1930s. Guilt-ridden at having disturbed their final resting place, Sam and Judith had them reburied in their yard. But the dead was now awake. No bueno. Electrical malfunctions, phantom sounds, and voices began to regularly occur. Possessions went missing, one of which was a pair of red shoes that were like Judith's favorites. They had just gone missing, and after a day of searching for these shoes, they were discovered atop Betty's grave. And it was later learned the day that they went missing just happened to be Betty's birthday. Reports from neighbors began piling up of electrical malfunctions, issues with lights and water faucets turning on and off. Activity got so unignorable and bad, Sam and Judith would file suit against these developers in court for not having disclosed that their house was built on top of a cemetery. They would lose the case, and when all was said and done, were ordered to pay $50,000 to cover court costs. That's $50,000 in 80s money. It's a lot. Now for Ben and Jean. The Williams had also moved into the subdivision just across the street from the Haneys. And around the same time of the start of the activity, they too began experiencing strange phenomena. Right away, Jean noticed that her plants kept dying. Couldn't keep them alive. A pet bird mysteriously up and died as well. She and Ben also noticed strangely shaped sinkholes that began appearing near their flower beds. Days after filling them in, they would reappear. The holes eerily resembled the long square shape a coffin might make. Soon after is when they would discover from a longtime resident that two sisters had been buried in their yard at the foot of a tree. The Williams realized the strange marks etched in the bark of the tree that they had noticed previously were, in fact, grave markers. The Williams also experienced spooky activity inside of their home, too. They would hear whispers, which were accompanied by a putrid smell, encounter pockets of cold air even in the dead heat of summer, saw shadows move along the walls of their own accord. Their daughter Carly recalled that the toilets would flush on their own, and while the water ran, you could hear what sounded like a low murmuring conversation. She said that you always felt a presence no matter where you went in the house. They would also hear footsteps, you know, when no one was there. Ben recounted a horrifying experience of entering his home late at night, it was like after work, and encountering two shadow figures. He followed them through the den, down the hallway, and they disappeared around the corner into the bedroom. When Ben turned the corner, he distinctly saw one of the figures stood at the bed, staring down at Jean. In an instant, he rushed the figure, landing on the bed, turning to look. The figure was gone. All of this is mighty frightening. And with the sheer number of people alone experiencing very similar activity, I think it's a good example of a credible haunting. But here's where it gets really dark. Within months of the activity starting, six close relatives of the Williams were diagnosed with cancer. Three of them would end up passing away within a year. It was the Williams' opinion that the spirits of the house were to blame. And then following Sam and Judith's suit, they too would file suit against the developers. They knew going in that they were going to need proof that their home too had been built on top of bodies. So Jean began digging in her yard to look for remains. But as she dug, she began to feel ill. When it got so bad she couldn't keep digging, her daughter Tina stepped in. Only 30 minutes in, she too began to feel ill, dizzy. She would go lay down to recoup, but would continue to feel sicker and dizzier. 911 was called. She was taken to the hospital, and 2 days later, she died at 30 years old from a massive heart attack. Jean believed that her daughter's death, too, was caused by the spirits and activity. Crazy case. I would have loved to have seen this case taken under the wing of investigators at the time. It's over 40 years old, so, kind of hard to justify now, especially considering that no owners that have lived in these properties since have really reported anything out of the ordinary, at least that we know. But as for the case of ghosts, actual ghosts causing death, it'd be nice to know that any real-world explanations behind, like, sudden illnesses could safely be ruled out. Things like, you know, chemical spills and sources of high electromagnetic frequency, genetic cancer predispositions, that kind of stuff. The sudden heart attack of Jean's daughter, ugh, it's tragic, certainly. And that young of an age, it's not something that happens frequently at that age, but, I mean, it can. Was it all the combination of growing fear from the discovery about the cemetery and imagination that led the family to then blame ghosts for the tragic but coincidental deaths that would occur in that span of time? Or was there something more to it than that? Can ghosts kill? I think this story, in particular, certainly makes a good case for how they could. Another possible good case for how they could can be seen not in haunted homes, but on haunted highways. The M6 is a very busy motorway in Britain. In 2006, a survey named it the most haunted road following a string of deaths. Psychic medium Mike Brooker points to a very particular section of the M6 between Junction 16 and 19, located in Cheshire County, calling it Britain's Bermuda Triangle. Drivers have reported phantom lorries. I had no idea what a lorry was either. It's a large commercial truck. They've also reported vanishing hitchhikers and Roman soldiers in this area, specifically between these junctions. Brooker, who has investigated crashes there since 1976, when and where his own friends were killed in a wreck, says there's a real negative energy on this particular part of the motorway and claims that crashes there are caused by ghosts. And perhaps he's right. He says in an article that I'm going to link below, the road is straight. This is supported by pictures that I found of the road. It's straight, no obstructions, wide open. Statistically speaking, a road like this should not be producing this kind of havoc. It is strange. And to show you just what I mean, I did a quick Google search for crashes in the area for just this year. Just in the first two pages of results, here's what I got. February 20th, two lanes on the M6 in Cheshire closed between J18 and J17 due to overturned vehicle. March 1st, one lane of the M6 in Cheshire is closed after a car flipped onto its roof. March 24, the M6 in Cheshire is closed southbound between J17 and J16. Officers responded to reports of a collision. April 5th, traffic currently at a standstill on the M6 northbound between J16 and J17. May 2nd, two lanes closed on the M6 motorway in Cheshire following a crash. May 10th, drivers on the M6 are facing delays following a collision near J18 this morning. May 22nd, just last week, two lanes closed on the M6 northbound in Cheshire between J16 and J17 due to collision. It's a lot, y'all. What the hell is going on between junctions 16 and 19? Brooker says that there appears to be two possible answers or reasons that this stretch could be haunted. One, the motorway was built on a Roman burial site. And two, it was built on the site of the slaughter of a Scottish army. Could make for some very interesting and scary residual stuff. Not to mention, with all of the modern deaths from car accidents since the motorway was built, I think we can safely assume an additional third reason that the stretch may be so haunted. Now, I did find other examples of what folks have labeled as death by ghost, but I either found them to be too debunkable and or unverifiable, or I'm not entirely sold on that particular gearing of the narrative. I think when we explore this angle of the ghost phenomenon, we start treading a fine line between what we might consider a vengeful ghost and an outright malevolent entity, a something else. Legends like the strangled inmate in cell 14D in Alcatraz. It's an incredibly spooky story. The legend goes that the inmate screamed of a creature with glowing eyes in the cell with him, found him strangled the next morning. Whether or not there's any originating seed of truth to this tale doesn't really matter. The description of the entity doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. The Amityville Horror, Malachi Martin's death, and speculations of said death following an exorcism that he'd been working on. These have been lumped into the death by ghost debate. If there is an ongoing debate about that, I don't know. These don't scream ghost of a human who once was living, as awful as they may have been while alive and mad as they may be now in the afterlife. These tales scream something else. They point to something else. We also tread a fine line between a mysterious but true story and our insanely gifted ability to create a connection for ourselves in order to explain the mysterious part. Humans have never liked being in the dark about something. We find an answer, or we create one where there was none before. Ghosts throughout time have easily filled that explanatory blank. It's convenient. When someone dies unexpectedly in a mysterious way, has a strange, inexplicable accident, when a legend or unconnected but supportive activity has already been witnessed leading up to a tragedy or strange event, it was a ghost, of course, who did it. What else could it have been? Can't explain it any other way. So it was a ghost. Because they were angry. Because they were evil. Because they are hungry. Hungry, hungry ghosts. Here is a good example of this that actually wound up in official records. In 1841, an aged laborer named Patrick Hayes died after falling downstairs at his place of lodging in Bristol. The wife of the landlord would later testify at the inquest that she had heard the man falling down the stairs and called out to see who it was. She said she got the response, "It is me, and I am dead." Final words. Under oath, the landlord's wife would then say, "I rather think he saw the ghost which infects the house. It is the ghost of a lady in silk and has been troublesome to some former lodgers. Two or three lodgers have been killed in the same house, no doubt frightened from the same cause. I've never seen the ghost myself." This story comes up in articles and threads geared towards showing that ghosts kill, cause accidents, frighten people to death. It's 190 years old, and we still consider it an example when the only witness to the event suggested it was a ghost she herself had never seen. Also, you think you would know whether it was definitely two or definitely three separate people who had died in your house. What a strange thing to be unsure of. I now doubt any and all of your following thoughts and suggestions. So we weave narratives and piece unconnected information together to give us answers to mysteries. And it makes us feel like we have a leg to stand on. It gives us a way to understand what we couldn't before. And the poor ghost is sitting there, just trying to live his afterlife in peace in the old abandoned barn, has to just take the reputation like a champ. and be our Patsy. I've arrived at the end of this one a little surprised that I didn't find more solid stories and accounts of ghosts causing physical harm, let alone killing a living person. And before you, but Kristen, me, I'm not speaking of the demonic. I'm not talking about poltergeists, sprites, interdimensional, what have yous. I am sincerely concerned today with the deceased, the physical realm bound, non-physical human. Because I've heard so many stories and legends of this being a possibility. I grew up on that stuff, those kinds of stories. It was a reason to be afraid of haunted locations. Ugh, old man Jenkins was such a nasty old man when he was alive. What's he gonna do to me now that I'm urban exploring his empty house? Nothing. He's not gonna do anything to you. Because even if he wanted to, I don't think he can. You know, didn't find anything today that makes me think that it works like that. He might give you a talking to in your dream. You know, we know they can do that. I don't know. The most solid story that I found was the story aired by Unsolved Mysteries. But I am left with questions on that one. Even more so, since I found a discrepancy in the original story. Disappointing, because it's a great story. A major hole was that the Haneys had the remains of Charlie and Betty reburied in their yard. It was a difficult decision for them to make, but they felt guilty. At one point in their story, they had even found a pair of red shoes that Judith Haney had lost on Betty's grave in their yard after an entire day of tearing the house apart looking for these shoes, to later discover that they were placed there on what would have been Betty's birthday, as if Charlie was giving her a present, which is very sweet. But why do the court documents from their lawsuit show that the developers they were suing had Charlie and Betty reburied, moved to a perpetual care cemetery, and on their dime? Kind of blows a hole in a major detail as to the extent of the activity. Also, Ben and Jean report that they began experiencing strange activity as soon as they moved in. Actually, there was one report that I saw that the workers, while originally building their home, complained of feeling ill and anxious while on the property. So stuff was already happening, even earlier. But Ben and Jean experienced things shortly after arriving. They were the first family to settle in that development in 1980. The Haneys would not even purchase their home across the street for another year, and then excavation on the pool and the unearthing and desecration of the graves wouldn't take place for another year or two after that. So the discovery and disruption of the graves was not an instigating factor of any paranormal activity at all. I'm not arguing the haunting. There was certainly something strange afoot in this area. But there's a hole to be poked in the timeline of events that has been reported in order to give the story more spooky flair, and thereby asserting that the desecration of graves might lead to angry ghosts, which might then lead to a full-on assault on the living. It doesn't debunk the story by any means, but details get a little twisted over time, you know? And because there's not a whole lot of follow-up that I can do otherwise on this story, I'm just left with questions, man, and doubt that ghosts had something to do with the deaths that would ultimately occur in this particular case. That's all. It's okay to have questions. It's okay to have doubts. Do I think ghosts kill? No. I have not been convinced. Not sold on this one, dudes. Do I think they can? Is it possible? We've talked enough about possible capabilities of the unseen during this season. Manipulations of energy, strength of focused emotion and energy. We can certainly imagine the potential. And yet, there's not one case on record, officially documented example of someone who died by ghost. That would be huge news. And maybe that's why they haunt, you know? Maybe that's why they scare, because they can't kill you. Or maybe they just don't want to, guys. Did you ever think about that, huh? If a ghost hated you enough to kill you, why in the world would they voluntarily put themselves in a position where you two are trapped together inside a location for eternity? Your being super annoying is maybe what has kept you alive, is what I'm saying. So, keep it up. It's a good theory, okay? I'm working on it. That's all I got for you today. Let's go ahead and do our final note. One of the scariest ghost stories that I ever heard, I realized this while working on this episode, wasn't even about a ghost at all. I was today years old when I realized that. Terrified me when I was a kid. I told it one time for an overnight lock-in sleepover thing that my elementary school did. To audible gasps, dudes. It was scary. It wasn't about a ghost. It was about human stupidity, in all actuality. I don't remember all of the details exactly how it went, but what I do remember, it was about a girl who went to a prom or a party looking like a princess, you know, all fancied up in her floor-length formal. And she gets to talking to a group of kids, and these kids are telling this story about a local graveyard where a corpse will grab you if you stand on its grave at midnight. And this girl's like, I ain't scared. And to prove she ain't scared, after the party, she goes to the cemetery alone in the middle of the night, finds the particular grave, and to show that she won this dare, plunges a knife that she brought with her into the grave. And smiling triumphantly, she turns to leave, quickly realizes she can't. She's stuck. Something or someone has got a hold of her dress. Terrified, she screams, struggles, sobs, trying to pull away. Ugh! The tales were true. The corpse had her. And then the next morning, they discover her body and the terrified scream etched into her face. Not realizing what she had done, she had pinned her own dress to the grave with her knife. The poor girl had died of fright. That's where you audibly gasp. I guess technically this would be a story about a Jen Ganger. I'm gonna get an email about that, I'm sure. But that was the story. No ghosts, no corpse, simply imagination and the overwhelming power of belief and fear, which is a powerful takeaway. Ghost stories are chock full of them. So, the next time you feel yourself getting a little too worked up, a little worried about something you don't understand, maybe you're on an overnight investigation, maybe you keep hearing and seeing things out of the corner of your eye in your house, you say to yourself, you say, self, this ghost may not kill me, but fear of it might. Is this my knife in the dress moment, or am I gonna calm down right the heck now and live to cut another cake? And you'll think back to this moment when I told you this story, and you'll say, thank you, Paranorm Girl. Thank you for helping me to not let fear get the better of me. You are so welcome, dudes. But you know what? You don't need to thank me. Simply follow the show on social at Paranorm Girl Pod for episode announcements, show news, and updates. That's all the thanks I need. The season is almost over, you guys. If you have a scary story to share and would like to hear it on the show, reach out, paranormgirlpod@gmail.com. Catch me live June 7th over on YouTube at Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen. First responders, supernatural experiences and encounters, and calls, 4:30 p.m. Pacific, 6:30 p.m. Central. I cannot wait for this one. I am super excited about these stories. Thank you guys so much for tuning in today. Ghost Children coming at you next. And hey, guys, even though a ghost may not get you, you don't know what else is out there. Okay? So, stay safe, keep the nightlight on, and sleep with one eye open.
Real talk. Sometimes life throws decisions our way that feel impossible to navigate. That's where a little guidance can make all the difference. At Psychic Source, our trusted psychics go beyond basic predictions. They provide real insight, helping you understand your situation, see your options clearly, and take confident next steps. Your reading is always private and judgment-free, so whether you're facing a crossroads in love, career, or life's bigger questions, you'll get honest, compassionate advice in a safe space. And the best part? Our psychics are available 24/7 by phone, chat, or video, whenever you need them. Plus, we stand by our readings. If you're not satisfied, it's free. Because when you have greater wisdom, you can create a better outcome. Ready to take control of your future? Get a reading for just 83 cents per minute, plus 3 minutes free. Visit PsychicSource.com and use promo code HELLO to get started. Psychic Source. Insight when you need it most.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.